One of the great paranormal investigators of our era, Jeff Belanger, back with us. A number of his books include Who's Haunting the White House? His website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We are going to talk about haunted America, and believe me, he's been all over the country to bring you what we're about to talk about in a moment. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Jeff Belanger back with us. Jeff jumped into the unexplained and leads a very haunted life himself. He's been fascinated with the supernatural since he was 10. And over the years, Jeff has interviewed hundreds of people about their experiences with an approach to the subject that truly makes the supernatural accessible to a wide group of people. He's the writer-researcher for the Ghost Adventures series on the Travel Channel. He hosts the online talk show 30-odd minutes. He will be part of a stream, a four-day stream event, which starts August 28th. You've heard it on the show before, the Lizzie Borden Murder House. It's going to be Friday through Monday, starting this Friday, the August 28th. We'll tell you more about it, but you can get information at darkzone.tv. Darkzone.tv. Jeffrey, welcome back to the program.
George, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Boy, this Lizzie Borden thing is going to be spooky.
So I live less than an hour from Fall River, Massachusetts, and I have been to this house many, many times over the years. And this is a cool thing. We did this back at the Conjuring House a couple months ago, and the whole idea was we're all locked inside. Let's put cameras on 24/7, bring in different people who know the case, and stream it and let people have just round-the-clock access. So that's the idea with the Dark Zone, and we're doing it again, this time at the Lizzie Borden House.
Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, gave her father 41.
We teach that to our kids here in Massachusetts.
But she got acquitted.
No, I love it. It's not any worse than Ring Around the Rosie, right? That's about dying from the plague.
How did she get acquitted in this thing?
And here's the thing. If anyone is interested in this case, all the court transcripts are up online for free. You can sit and read them for hours. You can read everything. You can read her depositions. You can read her interviews. The best I can come up with is that the all-male jury figured there's no way a woman would be capable of such a crime.
Unbelievable. Now, there was another person in the house at the time, too, wasn't there?
Yes. Bridget, the maid. And if have you been to the house, George? Have you ever had the chance?
I would not go in there if you paid me, Jeff.
Come on. Okay, first of all, it's not like some
I'll watch it on the stream. That'll be good enough for me.
There. Well, you'll see that it is not that large of a house. I mean, you know, it's bigger than my house, but it's not like a breaker's mansion in Newport. And all I can think of is if you were on the third floor, which allegedly Bridget the maid was, and someone is getting hacked to death with an axe one floor below you, I don't know how you wouldn't hear that and at least come around the corner and say, hey, everything okay?
Exactly. Her father was a wealthy banker, too, wasn't he?
He was, and he was home taking a nap on the couch and never got up. He met his end right there. And Lizzie claims, in the span of just maybe 15, 20 minutes while she was out back picking pears and then going up into the barn to get some fishing weights together for a fishing trip she was taking in a couple weeks, someone went into the house, stole nothing, murdered two people, and then quietly left.
Violently. You would think if there was going to be a murder, they'd do it and get out quick.
No.
You wouldn't whack somebody 40 times.
It was like 18, but still, that didn't work for the nursery rhyme. But yes, it was a crime of passion. And anyone who has watched even one episode of any CSI knows when you've got no sign of struggle, no sign of a break-in, nothing stolen, it's obvious that these victims knew their killers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Clearly.
We'll come back to the Lizzie Borden thing, and you can tell us about Dark Zone. They've been sponsoring. I've been hearing them on our program.
Yeah.
So they've been. As a matter of fact, they have a couple spots next hour, so we'll listen to that, too.
Good stuff. It's pretty innovative, and we're all stuck inside. We can't go investigate personally, but we can do this.
You and I went to the Eastern State Penitentiary with Tom Danheiser in Philadelphia. Remember that?
I remember doing prison time with you, of course.
You had didn't you have a computer with you?
We had all kinds of stuff with us, and one of the tools we were using was it was called the X-Cam at the time. I don't even know what they're calling it now, but it's what it is basically is it looks into the infrared part of the spectrum and it looks for people. This is Microsoft technology that's open source. Anybody can go download it because they, you know, the game, the Kinect system that you put yourself into video games, people, they allow that out there so you can develop games. The software was used in order to look into the infrared part of the spectrum and look for people. That's what the software does. And once in a while, something turns up that you don't see in the environment. And the software is just doing what it does. It's looking for people. And that was intriguing, right? I mean, so when something turns up that's not there, or you know, you see a living person and then next to it another one, you start to scratch your head. This was developed by a engineer named Bill Chappell. We've used it on Ghost Adventures, and now you've seen it on just about every paranormal TV show. But way back then, That was the first, you know, versions of this new system.
Well, it was strange being in Al Capone's cell. It was just a weird feeling.
Yeah, not all prisoners are created equal, are they?
How many years was he in there? 12? Something like that?
I don't know. But just to set it up, when you go into Eastern State, it's the design is incredible, right? So it's like a wagon wheel, meaning if you're in the middle where the guards were, you three or four people could stand back to back and you could see the entire prison. You could look down all the hallways and keep track of things. Really intelligent design. And this is where we get the word penitent, right? Penitentiary comes from Eastern State.
Uh-huh.
Because back then, you know, before Eastern State, prisons were, I mean, they're still awful places, but back then they put everybody into one big courtyard. I mean, you had debtors and you had petty thieves and you had murderers and rapists and all in one area, and it was just so incredibly dangerous for everyone. But at Eastern State, they said, this will be different. Everything was supposed to be solitary confinement. There was a window, a slit in the up top, so you could look out into the sky and you could pray to God and be penitent for your sins. You talk to no one. If they had to move you from one cell to another, they would put a mask over your face so you couldn't see any people at all. It was unlike anything that had ever been done before. Now, that, of course, is like spending years in solitary confinement, which is maddening at the same time. But it was different, right? They were trying to do something different. And that, I believe, leaves a mark. It leaves a stain. And when you walk through there, you could feel it. I mean, you remember, right? We were there at night.
Oh, yeah. It was weird.
It's very weird. And of course, your mind starts to wander to, well, who was in here? I mean, we know Capone. And Capone's cell was different from all these wings, right? It was off on its own. It had a nice furniture. They used to keep the door open for him so he could kind of come and go, not outside of the prison grounds, but at least come and go outside of his cell because he was Al Capone. But yeah, the rest of it, though, that was just a place where, you know, we keep the worst of society. And when you walk through, I don't know if you remember some of those cell blocks where you could walk down the middle and you can kind of see where you're going, but you look to your left and your right and you see these cell doors, and some are open, and it's just blacker than black in there. You know, it's just so dark,
strange, yeah.
And you wonder who was in there, who was in that one, what did they do? And that makes us connect to this location. We understand its history, we understand its purpose, and it just takes you to a dark place. A
couple of years prior to that, Jeffrey, we all hooked up at the Queen Mary in Long Beach, California.
We did, and that's a very different kind of haunt, isn't it? I mean, pretty different from a prison. The Queen Mary is one of those places that I think you just keep coming back to. You know, number one, what I love about it, it's kind of like the Lizzie Borden house. When you walk onto the Queen Mary, you're stepping back in time. You can forget what year it is. You're back in the 1930s on a transatlantic ocean liner.
Yeah, you feel like you're on the Titanic.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, you go up to the observation bar and you have like a sidecar, an old fashioned, something you'd never drink anywhere else, right? You say, yeah, this makes sense here. And you walk down those old hallways, and you can just imagine. This is exactly what it looked like 1931 when it made its maiden voyage, built to hold 3,000 passengers comfortably, which, of course, would make it a dwarf today compared to some of the modern cruise ships. But back then, this was a state-of-the-art. But it was short-lived, right? I mean,
yeah.
The reason this place is so haunted is because it didn't make it as a ocean liner very long. It got pressed into service during World War II to become a troop ship.
That's right. It carried thousands of troops all over the place.
So remember I said 3,000 passengers. That's what it was built to hold, passengers and crew. In 1942, she was painted gray. They called her the Gray Ghost. And at its max, Queen Mary carried 16,683 troops at once.
Why would it be haunted, Jeffrey?
So during World War II, so many things happened. When you had 16,000 plus on deck, on the ship, rather, you had to take eight-hour shifts, 8 hours in a bunk, 8 hours just standing on deck because there's nowhere to put you, 8 hours doing work of some kind. It was just packed. And the ship had to run these zigzag patterns to evade the German U-boats, always moving, never stopping. And the Queen Mary had...
What a target. My God.
Well, right. I mean, yes. Imagine taking out 16,000 troops in one shot.
Bang.
And obviously not well-armed. It's a cruise ship. So on October 2nd, 1942, the Queen Mary is running these zigzag patterns, and the Scirocco is her escort ship. And through some mishap, the Scirocco gets in the way of the Queen Mary, and the Queen Mary cuts through the much smaller ship, sinking it. Almost instantly, 338 men go into the ocean, and the worst part is the Queen Mary can't stop to help. They all died.
Oh.
Every one of them. And that's what life was like during World War II. That's what life was like on that ship. And that's just one event. Of course, they had POWs on there, some who died on the ship. There were accidents and things like that. It's just got so much life and history moving through it that I believe it still kind of echoes.
And some non-troops died there when it was the luxury cruise liner, right?
Of course. People have heart attacks. People have accidents. There was an accident down in the engine room. The doors, I don't know if you remember being down there, but these doors are made to seal shut in the case of some sort of leak, right? They have
yes.
to become airtight.
They
got
to protect the ship.
Of course. But if you get in the way of that mechanism as it's closing, which one person did down in the engine room, you literally could be cut in half, and that did happen to one of the crewmen. And that's one of the events that haunts down there. And I'll tell you, I don't know if you got to be down there during the investigation part for that one section, but you're down there in the engine room, and you're looking up at all this almost century-old rusted metal all around you. It's, you know, it's very heavy. It's very old.
It's a creaky ship.
It's creaking and groaning. It talks, you know, and you feel it and you connect to it and you say, wow, this is where so much happened. So much history took place right where I'm standing. And that's the thing I'm most passionate about when it comes to looking at haunts all over the world, but especially here in America, is maybe I have an ancestor who was on the ship at one point. Maybe, right? All these connections.
Why do you keep doing what you do, Jeff? I mean, you are into this in a big, big way.
Yeah, somehow I turned it into a career, which is just amazing, right?
One of your bios that I had seen years ago said, you're obsessed with the unexplained.
I think I am, because these are the biggest questions we've ever asked, right? Is there life after death? I'm not the first to ask it. You're not the first. This goes back thousands and thousands of years and endless generations. What happens after we die? Why is it important that we preserve our history? Why do we need to connect to it? I believe that there's some lesson, right? These are sermons from our own past related to us, lessons that we haven't learned yet. And every one of these buildings has some lesson to teach us. And I love that connection, because when you go into a haunted place, you're connecting with that building, its history, its community. And when we share these stories, we're connecting with each other. And that's the key, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, we get to strip Absolutely. Out all the weird dogmas and rules of religion and just talk about one thing. It's haunted. And if you believe it's haunted, if you believe in ghosts, as I do, then you must believe in some sort of afterlife. And then from there, we can argue and, you know, do whatever. But before that, before we start arguing, let's just break it down to that one simple conclusion.
What was the supernatural experience when you were 10?
So when I was 10, it started because I grew up in Newtown, Connecticut, and it's a great historic little old town. It was the town next to Ed and Lorraine Warren, who lived in Monroe. I knew them since I was about 12 years old and Ooh. Saw their stories. But I had a buddy who lived just down the street. His house was built in 1760, right? His house was older than America. And we would have sleepovers. And he said, "Oh, by the way, it's haunted." I said, "What do you mean it's haunted?" He said, "Well, there's this old guy that seems to live here with us. He's not hurting anything. He just kind of walks down the hall and disappears." And I was intrigued. And his parents said, "Yeah, look, please don't tell your parents. They'll think we're crazy. They'll have us locked up, you know." But it was so matter of fact. It was so not dangerous or they didn't even seem all that frightened. And I'm saying, "Can I live here for a week? I want to see this for myself. I want to connect to it." And that sort of started me on this path. And then living in a town like that, I had other friends who said, "Oh, my house is haunted too." Of course it is. It's, you know, 200 years old. And I thought, well, what does that mean? I was raised Catholic, you know, and that's the baggage I carry. And I said, "Well, where do ghosts fit in, Father Burge?" You know, and then he would say, "Well, you know, there's a lot we don't fully understand." God bless him. He was very open-minded. And I think just that started me on this journey of wanting to see it for myself. And that's still, you know, what I'm doing all these years later.
I mean, you have turned it into a career, haven't you?
Yeah, right. I mean, the career started, I mean, I went full time in 2004. So 16 years ago, I was able to make the leap and just do this. And it was never a career that you plan, you know. I think sometimes it finds you. You know, I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to do that. That I knew. And I was writing for newspapers and magazines. And then eventually I got my first book deal. And then I started working on TV projects and things like that. And I think I woke up one day and I just said, "Oh, my goodness, this is my job now." And then I called my mom. I said, "Hey, Mom, guess what I do?"
I love it. You know our colleague Dave Schrader, he loves this stuff too.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I've known Dave for years. And
he's into this.
Yeah, the Queen Mary, wasn't that his event where we got together?
I think so.
Yeah, that was one of his events there.
I think
and,
so.
Yeah, it's such a great way to connect with people that are also asking questions, like inquisitive minds who want to know, are we alone in the universe? What happens after we die? What are the creatures that walk the earth with us? These are the big ones.
In Boston, how close are you to Fitchburg and Leominster?
Oh, not far at all. Leominster, Plastic City, of course. 45
all my minutes. Relatives are in Fitchburg. They're all
it's
out
Fitchburg.
There.
Yeah. So do you know what cryptid came from Leominster, Massachusetts?
No, I do not.
Millions upon millions all over the world, and I guarantee you that you've seen one personally. Leominster, Massachusetts gave the world, and you can't give it back, the plastic pink lawn flamingo.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. All right. You threw me a curve on that. I knew that, but that's fantastic. And you can tell that I've been there before because I didn't say Leominster.
No, that's right. Leominster. Well done.
Same with Worcester.
Worcester. That's right. We.
How come you don't have a New England accent?
You know, George, if you got a few drinks in me, it would spill out. But
does it come out?
It's pretty late here, and I thought I'd do this one sober.
Speaking of traveling, has COVID affected anything for you yet?
It affected everything for me.
Were you going to go to Contact in the Desert? Were you headed for that?
I was not scheduled on that one.
Not that one. But we've had some events canceled.
Oh, I had everything canceled. The good news is I'm doing a ton of stuff virtually. So I do these story programs. I do them for libraries and colleges and universities. And the good news is, if anyone's interested, I've got something like 40 planned between now and December. They're virtual. Many of them are
40?
40, 40, yeah. They're sponsored by the libraries and different organizations, and you can register for a Zoom, you know, their Zoom thing. So wherever you are, you can register. They're all on my website, everything that I've got coming up.
Super. We've got that linked up for you as well.
And I miss live audiences so much because there's...
I feed off that.
Oh, please. I love sharing these stories in person because when you see people lean forward and you know it's hitting them...
you hear them. They laugh, they cry, you know, awe. And you don't get that on the digital end of it.
No, but I mean, you know, and that's why you like to do your live broadcast too, right? I mean,
that's right.
You get to do what you do, and then get the feedback. And I mean, we hope it's hitting when we're out there, when we're on the radio, and we're just broadcasting. But when you get to see the audience, it's just so much better.
Jeffrey, when we come back, let's talk about the Pennhurst Asylum, the Baker Hotel, which is in Texas, and some other areas. That we'll dive back into the Lizzie Borden adventure. Our webmaster this week and news editor Tim Banal spent a little moment at the Lizzie Borden house several weeks ago, and he simply said, "You know what? It's pretty cool." We'll be back with more in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Jeff Bellinger back with us. His website is his name, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. A couple of his other books include Communicating with the Dead, The Nightmare Encyclopedia. Jeff, what convinces you so much that the other side is the real thing?
You know, I don't consider myself psychic or anything like that. And I've been doing this a long, long time, all over the world. And every once in a while, I've had an experience that I can't explain with any other word other than ghost or spirit. And that is a game changer. When you go through that experience, when you see something and you reach that conclusion, it changes you. It changes everything inside of you. It changes your DNA. And that's happened to me. It happened to me the first time. It actually happened in Paris, France. I was in the catacombs of Paris. I was below the city, surrounded by millions of human skeletons, alone, walking down a hallway when I see this shadow the size of a man come across, move from the right side to the left and go back. And I just froze. And I went, wait a minute, you know, I'm alone down here. And I look, and there's no side tunnels up there. The tunnel was so narrow, no one could have come up from behind me. And that was the way out, was ahead. And I just went, okay, if that's not a ghost, I have no other word for that. And it's the kind of experience that takes days, weeks, months, even years to sink in, where you just went. And by that point, keep in mind, I had interviewed hundreds of people about their ghost experiences at that point. Now it's thousands. But back then, I went, this must be what they were talking about. I didn't ask for it. I wasn't seeking it. I wasn't trying to commune or anything. It just happened when I was there. And I will never forget it. And I want it to happen again. It's so rare for me, but it has happened.
Jeff, let's talk about the Pennhurst Asylum in Spring City, Pennsylvania. What can you tell us about this place?
This is one of those places that I come back to again and again because I think it's important. It's important that we talk about it, and it's important that this building haunt us. I first got acquainted with it, I think it was season two of Ghost Adventures when we were filming there, and I thought, okay, abandoned asylum. I know what to do. You know, I know these stories. There are abandoned asylums all over the world, all over the United States, and their stories are so similar. You know, the way we treated people with mental disabilities was absolutely inhuman centuries ago. People would be locked, just put to prison or locked in basements or attics. I mean, that happened. Families were so embarrassed. But then, you know, the asylum started to form. The idea that we could build these campuses where people could live good lives. They could grow their own food. They could be self-sustaining. They could, you know, have a decent life. And things got better. But then eventually we've got the Great Depression and places get overcrowded and they get much worse. So Pennhurst, what makes Pennhurst different than every other asylum I've ever looked into, and I've looked into a lot, is there's actually a federal law called the Pennhurst Law that has to do with how you can and cannot treat people with mental disabilities based on atrocities that took place in this asylum in the 1960s and 1970s.
Really? Not too far away.
No, I mean, I was alive when some of these things happened.
And they gave them shock treatment and things like that, didn't they?
Sure, but everyone did that. That was actually just cutting-edge treatment at one point. Everyone did it. That was not the issue. The issue was this place, Pennhurst, which opened in 1908. It was called Pennsylvania State Institution for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. That was what they called it. Within 4 years, they're already getting write-ups about the poor treatment of patients. And this campus, it's beautiful. I mean, under different circumstances, it could look like a college. You know, right outside of Philadelphia, it's in the woods, these big, beautiful buildings. But inside, the treatment just got worse and worse. As it got overcrowded, as funding gets cut, you had staff that was just stretched so thin. It's just awful. So I got to interview a former nurse who told me that she and another nurse, their job was to go in the morning, and there was 100 beds with patients that are just had such profound disabilities they can't leave their beds without a great deal of assistance. And so they would just change the adult diapers on each patient, 100 beds. And by the time they got done with those 100 beds, the two of them changing diapers, it was pretty much time to go back and start again. And some of those patients would rub their feces in their hair and on their skin, not because they don't know any better, but because they knew if they did that, they would get a bath, and they would get human contact, and they would get touch, and they would get attention. something they wouldn't get otherwise.
Jeez. It was closed by a judge, wasn't it?
It was, but before that happened, an investigative reporter named Bill Baldini had access to the building. And keep in mind, so this stuff is happening inside. I spoke to a patient, George, who said, if you bit someone more than once, they removed all your teeth, right? And they would tell you,
jeez,
at Penhurst, if you drop off your loved one, your mother, your sister, your children, whatever, don't visit, don't write, don't call. It'll mess up the routine. Just leave it to us.
Until we call you back or something like that.
Yeah, and people trusted them. Bill Baldini, this local reporter from Philadelphia, in 1968, he goes inside and he sees children literally locked in dog kennels, in cages, because the short staff didn't know what else to do with them. They didn't know how to deal with kids with these behavioral issues, and so they were locked into cages. And so he runs this expose called Suffer the Little Children, and that brings a lot of attention to Penhurst. And eventually, in 1977, a U.S. district judge found Penhurst guilty of violating patients' constitutional rights. And from there, things start to change, right? That then you've got this line in the sand. You can't let this happen. And this building, when you go into them, George, there's these tunnels that connect underneath the various buildings.
Well, and if you weren't mentally ill when you went in, you sure were when you came out of that place.
Imagine those conditions. And the other thing, too, you know, some of the people who worked there, they weren't monsters. They were just stretched as thin as they could go. I mean, imagine your job all day is to just try to change diapers on people and just keep up with that. And there's not enough people to even do that. We wouldn't treat an animal that way. You wouldn't treat your dog that way. And these were human beings. And these, not only were they human beings, they were human beings that needed more care than the rest of us. And that building is just haunted throughout. And I remember the first time we got there, we were setting up to film, but I mean, we hadn't been there 5 minutes, and we're down in these tunnels, and just way in the distance, we hear this like laughter, and then this rush of cold air just goes whoosh, right by. And it was myself and two other people. We look at each other, and it felt like the building wanted to talk, right? It had a story to tell. And I know some people think that this is sort of like exploitive, right? The idea that we're talking about these painful places and exploiting their ghost stories or whatever. But I think telling a story like that forces us to look in the mirror and say, wait a minute, we lived in a country. We were alive at the time. We lived in a country that allowed a place like this to not only exist, but to treat people that way. We allowed it to be.
And I bet it was that way all around the country.
Of course it was. Of course it was.
All these places.
Yeah, but this one seemed to be just a cut above or below, if you prefer, some of the others. But yeah, the conditions were like this all over. And do you want to live in a country that allows this to happen to the people that need the most help? And that's what a ghost legend can do, right? And I mean, I do believe it's haunted because it begs to tell its story. It begs to say, remember what happened here. Don't let this happen again. That's why it's so important to me that some of these stories, that's the moral from the past. That's the thing we haven't learned. How do we treat people that need the most help? And this building just cries out to say, not like this.
In 1929, a 450-guest room hotel called the Baker Hotel was built in Mineral Wells, Texas. What happened to it?
Mineral Wells is an interesting story because this story also repeats around the country. But you go all the way back to 1877, and what happened is a judge named James Lynch settles the area. He digs a well, and he thought the water tasted a little bit funny. But his wife was drinking it, and she said, boy, this seems to cure her rheumatism. And that was very exciting, and pretty soon other wells are dug. And the story goes, by the time they dug the third well, that's when they started to get famous. There was a woman, they said, was demented, and she drank from this well every day, and she got better. She calmed down. She was more herself again. And locals were calling this well the Crazy Woman's Well, which eventually gave rise to the term crazy water. Well, pretty soon, the reputation is growing, and now people are flocking to this little town to say, well, I want some of that water. I need a cure. I have my own issues. And people were getting better, and they started to say, well, there's so many people coming in. We need a hotel. And that's when T.B. Baker built his grand hotel and opened it in 1929. Because back then, people would come to places like Mineral Wells, and they would stay for weeks, and they would drink the water, and they would bathe in the water, and they would relax. And some of these folks got better from whatever it was.
It's almost like lords.
Sure, but the difference was, if you, I mean, where in our life today do we go somewhere to just relax? I mean, sure, yeah.
Right now, there's no place.
No place, right. If we're fortunate enough to be able to afford vacations to tropical islands or whatever, then great. You know, you get some of that. But beyond the relaxation, you had this mineral water. You were getting minerals, and there was different, mineral compositions. There was calcium and magnesium and sulfates in this water, and it really did seem to help people. It all went to hell. Because over time, the FDA, which was formed in 1906, is gaining a lot more power and influence. And by the 40s and 50s, they're pretty much saying anything that you're going to call medicinal has to be pharmaceutical and it has to be approved by the FDA. So Mineral Wells, for decades, had been selling and exploiting their medicinal mineral water. And well, you can't call it medicine anymore, and you can't call it this. Medicine is a pill. It's a pill you take to make you better. And pretty soon that changed the whole culture of the entire United States. It put Mineral Wells pretty much out of business. And that story's not unique. I mean, I can tell you a story in Maine just like it, where there were mineral springs and people went there for resorts.
They were all over the place.
They were everywhere. And it put them all out of business because now people thought, well, medicine comes from pills that you take instead of, you know, relaxing, getting into the water, changing your scenery, changing your life for just a couple of weeks. And we lost that. It's a shame.
And it's crazy water.
It's crazy water. Well, I mean, it made you better. And there's really something to that. And now we've got a vitamin and mineral industry that's worth billions, right?
Instead Absolutely.
Of, you know, from our water, we look for pills, and we want to take it this morning and be better by lunchtime.
Jeff Ballinger with us here as we're talking about some haunted places. Jeff, let's get back to the Lizzie Borden house in Fall River, Massachusetts, which will be the DarkZone.tv's 4-day live stream, which we'll talk about next hour.
Yeah.
But this place, you've been there.
Oh,
is it creepy?
You know, when you know the history, it certainly is. Because when you walk inside, you know, keep in mind, this crime took place August 4th.
Two people killed.
Two people are murdered. That's a fact. And
With an axe.
And when you walk in, the crime scene photos are hanging on the wall in the room where it happened, just as a reminder.
Oh, my God. Do they have, you know, where they put tape where a body was? Do they have that there?
No, nothing like that. But, okay. I mean, they have meticulously redecorated this home to look like it did in 1892. They looked at all the old photographs that were available of the house. They reproduced everything, the furniture, the carpet, the wallpaper, everything. So when you step in there, you feel like you're in 1892, just like when we were on the Queen.
Is it a mansion?
No, I don't think anyone would call this a mansion. The interesting thing about the house is especially the upstairs. Most homes have a hallway that connects the bedrooms. This house used to be kind of like a duplex, and it was broken through to connect the two. So one bedroom sort of feeds into the next. It's a strange...
Almost like they're connected.
Yeah, it's a very strange upstairs, not like anything you've ever seen. But no, not that large. I don't know. I'm guessing 3,000 square feet? 3,500 maybe? Like not a mansion at all.
Not a mansion. A nice size house, but not a mansion.
Absolutely. And one of the speculations is that, you know, Mr. Borden was a wealthy man in Fall River, and the speculation was that Lizzie felt like, well, we should have a bigger house. We should live someplace more grandiose. We should be living higher on the hog. And he was a penny pincher. And so that, you know, who knows?
I mean, how old was she, Jeff, when the trial occurred?
She was 32.
32 years old. Okay, so she wasn't a kid.
No, and she wasn't married, still living at home. Andrew is 70. Her father's 70 years old, and her stepmother, Abby, is 64 at the time. And so,
no siblings?
She did have a sibling. She had a sister, yeah, and who was not in the house. So you've got this strange dynamic. Why would you murder a 70-year-old? I mean, how much longer has he got if you're trying to get the inheritance, right? There's a lot of strangeness around what the motive could have been. But there's something about this case. It captivated not just the region, but the whole country.
I mean, what did the neighbors say about her? Anything?
So the neighbors, you know, no one really had a clue. It was just one of those things where, how did this happen? Why did it happen? But the thing is, George, some stuff came to light just this past summer that I hadn't heard about before.
About her?
About the case. So two things. The summer before, June 24th, 1891, I didn't know this until just this past summer, they had a daytime break-in at the Borden house.
Someone broke in,
stole about $75 worth of money, some horse car tickets, and a few earrings, a few things. It was a, you know, just to grab what they could, and they got out. And the reason this is important is because this, you know, keep in mind, this is 14 months earlier. Someone did that, and no one could figure out how they got in the house. And it was Lizzie Borden who actually said, well, you know, the cellar door was open. Maybe someone came in that way, meaning they would have had to know the house, right, to know, get in through the cellar door, get what you're going to steal, and then get back out. And it was one of those things where it was unsolved, just, hey, you know, bad luck, sorry. But suddenly when you look at it in the context of what happened a year later, could it have been Lizzie that did it in an effort to sort of set up, hey, look, we've been robbed
as an alibi, that's right.
Right, like was it that premeditated a whole year in advance, or was there just someone going around and getting into this house and you know, stealing from the family?
Well, if they used that in the trial, it sure helped her because she got acquitted.
She did, and it's so insane, all the evidence, right? You're home for 15 minutes. You don't see or hear anything while this happens.
Hold on for a second, Jeff. We're at the top of the hour. Let's come back and talk more about the Lizzie Borden house. And then you can tell us about the live stream that's going to occur for 4 days starting Friday, August 28th.